Welcome to the Real Love podcast series, right here on the Sharon Salzberg Meta Hour. This series features a variety of conversations with the world's finest thinkers and teachers, exploring Sharon's latest book, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection.
So, welcome back to Sharon. There was one...
Yay! Whoa, thank you. That's a New Yorker.
There was one question left hanging last night that I promised I'd answer. It's Anne's question about the science. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, Anne, and I just said to Sharon, I think it goes to faith. Like, for a lot of us, it helps to know scientifically what the effects are of this practice, just to beef up our own faith. And so I'm just going to give you a little list of, I've been directing our research institute for the last 10 years, and we do know something now, and Sharon probably will add to this, but just very briefly in a few minutes, because I want Sharon to dive into a lot of other topics. The first thing we know is that regular practitioners of metta actually significantly improve their perspective taking. That is, their capacity, our capacity, to take the perspective of another. This is mediated through the temporal parietal junction and the insula. Do I have any brain scientists in here? You'll probably know more about it than I do, but this is a very significant finding, and it goes to exactly what Sharon's been teaching about the capacity to make some space around your own rigidly held views. So perspective taking, we know. The plasticity of the autonomic nervous system. So we know that practitioners of metta and other forms of meditation and yoga, the practice actually tones the vagus nerve, the big, vagus means wandering, the big nerve that goes through the whole body. And what that means is that, and this again goes to what Sharon was teaching, I think, last night, that it moves back and forth between states of arousal and states of relaxation more quickly. It's more plastic. We know this with heart rate variability, too. There is something called a refractory state, which is a very, and we all know this, a very dense state of craving or aversion. You might say a dense, intractable, refractory state of grasping or hatred. And we all know these because we have them from time to time, just one of those ones you cannot shake. We know that regular, and in the, I would say this is the hell realm, right? That's what we would call it in the yoga tradition, that dense state of grasping or aversion. We know that refractory states are significantly, the length of refractory states are significantly modified by practice, which is a really good thing. And I honestly, I've noticed that in myself. I come from a very anxious tribe of kind of high wasps who are really nervous about everything. And
I didn't know there were people like
that.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely. That's why yesterday when the heat didn't work, it just totally threw me, because I have this whole thing in my family about being a host. They're in my house. The heat doesn't work. I'm pissed.
Well, I know a lot of Jews like that. I just didn't know any wasps like that.
And I really got in. My staff will tell you, like, it threw me. I was in a refractory state most of the morning. But I have found that that's lessened just a little bit. Okay. We know that it lessens reactivity and inflammation, and of course those things lead to depression, heart disease, diabetes. Really interesting, and this came out of a study that we did through our friend Sarah Lazar, who's with Richie Davidson, one of the top fMRI brain study folks in the country, enhances fluid intelligence. So fluid intelligence is that kind of intelligence. Again, not learning the state capitals, but creativity, the capacity to think out of the box. Sharon's lately, in her, your teaching, I've noticed a lot of vein of creativity. It enhances creativity. And finally, neural networks are more robust with this kind of practice. And that simply means that more parts of the brain are talking to each other more of the time. This is sometimes called, Sarah Lazar did this study, and it's called small-worldedness, which means you can get to any part of the world of the brain from any other part really fast. So it's all in the neighborhood. Do you have anything to add to that?
Lily, I'm not sure this microphone is in the right place. Hello. And then it's...
We got help coming.
Yeah.
The cavalry's coming.
You're such a good host. I had to tell you that reminded me of a story. It's true. I don't know many people like that. I meant the WASP part. Because I know quite a number of Jewish people exactly like that. I was staying with a friend of mine. I was working on my book, which I did for a very long time, since I was so late with it, Real Love. And I was staying with this friend in California who was helping me with the book, and she said she wanted to throw a dinner party and have friends of mine come over. And I said, don't do that. I said, in this day and age, to have a dinner party is like a very anxiety-producing affair. You know, because you have the paleo people, and then you have the vegans, and you have the gluten-free people, and the sugar-free people, and people who only eat fruit, and people who won't eat fruit, you know. And like I said, don't do it. You know, nice thought, but she really wanted to do it. And she said, I'll make a salmon. And I said, well, I have a few vegan friends I'd like to invite. And she said, I'll make this eggplant dish. I said, let me check. So sure enough, they don't eat eggplant. And we went through this whole thing. This poor woman was like such a... So these people, these friends of mine who were coming, who were very strict about their food, they said, tell her not to worry. We'll bring our own food. And I said, she's a Jewish woman of a certain age. I said, she'd die before she'd let you bring her own food. So anyway, all that came. I thought, that's called the refractory state. What do you know? Thank you so much for that. It would be great if you wrote that up someday and people could refer to it, because it's hard sometimes to collate and find the different research projects if you're interested in them. What we would say anecdotally, you know, experientially, is that even though practices combine those skills I talked about of concentration, mindfulness, and loving kindness, certainly there are practices that emphasize a particular strand of that. And there hasn't been a lot of research differentiating those different kinds of methodologies. What we'd say anecdotally is that mindfulness helps us see the difference between what's actually happening and the story we are weaving about it. I need this to last forever. This is great. This is painful. And it's not to say we will stop having a narrative, because we won't. And not all narratives are damaging. Some are very onward leading. They're encouraging. They bring us together. They remind us of our own potential. And some, of course, are very old. They are very damaging. They're kind of useless. They come along quickly. But still, as quick as they can be, we can see the gap. We can find the gap and remind ourselves this is what's actually happening right now. You know, even as the punch of the proliferation is starting to heat up, you know, we can get in there in between the two. And then we choose. Do I want to take this story to heart? Do I want to strengthen it? Do I want to nourish it? Is this best just let go of? And in some distinction to that, practices which emphasize loving kindness, like the metta practice, they say we'll switch our default story. So what rushes in most quickly? What's the kind of most immediate interpretation? If we have been motivated, for example, largely by fear in what we do or what we say or what we hold back from doing or saying, which is another kind of action, and we strengthen loving kindness, we will find we are motivated more and more and more by a sense of connection. And I emphasize the motivated part because, remember I said, that's the arena of the psyche that is most affected. It's not what we'll do, but why we do things. It's not fair to ourselves, most of all, to say, well, if my metta were really good, then I'd say yes to everything. Or I'd give a dollar to everyone on the street who asked me. It's not what we'll do, because there are a whole lot of other factors that figure into that decision point. I mean, I've seen that. We've all seen that in ourselves and in others, right? But why we do things, why we say yes, even why we say no, can we do that with a heart that is acknowledging that we're connected rather than fear and hatred and kind of just disconnection from somebody else? That's what shifts. And it shifts in ways that are not, they're not stylized, they're not labored. It's not like you leave here and you go home and you run into a neighbor and you think, oh, they're the most annoying person in the world, but the weekend was called loving kindness. You know, I don't want them above all to think that I failed, you know, so I'll just smile. It's not like that. The shifts inside of us happen in terms of this whole field of motivation. So we find we're different. It can even be a big surprise, like, wow, that was different, you know? Look at that, I dropped that jar, I blew it, I did that, I was so much nicer to myself, or I had so much more resilience and ability to start over. I met that stranger and I actually listened to them, or, you know, look at that. You know, so it's not like a self-conscious addition. And, you know, so people, as I said, are starting to do more kind of, I guess, differential research between these practices. I find that interesting. I find the research very interesting, mostly in the way Stephen talked about, in that it's inspiring for some people. I mean, there are many venues that are not Kripalu or the Insight Meditation Society, and if you walked in and said, let's chant Om three times, you know, it would be like, I don't think so. But you could pull out a piece of paper like that and say, you know, or these are the consequences of stress. This is what it's shown. Thus far, meditation can do in terms of stress, and it's like a new languaging. So I think of it sometimes the way Buddha's teaching went from country to country, and one of the things they say the Buddha said, not country to country, but even within India, when he had his first group of disciples that were about to go out to teach, and it was a very beautiful, poetic exhortation about intention, basically, like, teach for the good of the many, the welfare of the many, you know, like, be motivated by compassion, in other words. And the last thing he said was, teach in the local idiom. And so what's our local idiom? It's this. One of the main scientists who has focused almost exclusively on loving kindness research is Barbara Fredrickson at the University of North Carolina. She has a couple of books out, one called Positivity, and her, I think, most recent book is called Love 2.0. She talks a lot about the vagus nerve and all of that. And she, amongst other people, is, you know, they are trying to see the difference. I mean, I don't know many people who will look at the difference in terms of the neuroplasticity or the... you know, genetic expression, which is the hot new field. I mean, the brain is old hot now, I'm told. You know, everything's about genetic expression and cutting-edge research, which I never understood, and then someone explained to me. They said, well, I don't know, I just saw Richie, so he explained it again. He said it's like our genes have little loudspeakers on them, and they can be turned up or turned down. And so even if you have a genetic load for some condition or issue, that loudspeaker can be turned way down. And these days, I think that's so fascinating because of the studies that are coming out about intergenerational effects of trauma, for example. You know, and it's not a small thing to be able to affect that loudspeaker. Even if we can't change the DNA, we can make it irrelevant. Think of that. You know, so that's really what a lot of research is emphasizing now. But one of the issues has been that most of the research that is considered really valid or, you know, very, very good, rigorous science has been on mindfulness and not so much on loving kindness as of yet. But the wave is really happening, which makes me very happy, of course.
And you bring up Barbara Fredrickson, who whose theory is called Broaden and Build.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in this, this is really where to go. She studies Broaden and Build, Barbara Fredrickson. And is she in North Carolina?
She's
now?
In North Carolina.
Okay. The theory is basically that we can systematically practice these states, these mind states that we're practicing this weekend. And over time, they actually become traits. They become traits. They become positive patterns. She does more work on joy, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Highly recommended reading, Barbara Fredrickson.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that about Broaden and Build, because I watched it pass right through my mind, and it went out. Because I think that's a significant thing to reflect on if we think about the positive quality. She's a positive psychologist, so that, you know, is her slant on things. We think about practicing gratitude. We think about practicing appreciation or joy. And what that means is you're not manufacturing it, but you take a moment. In psychology, it's called savoring. We can be very dismissive of the joy and delight that comes our way. Either we're quite distracted when it happens, or it's not suiting our idea. I find myself telling this story a lot lately too, and I have been going to Washington, D.C. quite regularly to teach, and one year this friend took me to the area, you know, where there are all the, there's this concentration of cherry trees, and when they bloom, it's cherry blossom season, and we got there, and I just thought it was so exquisite. And these little delicate pink blossoms, and so many of them, I thought it was so beautiful. And then my friend said, oh, no, it's past the peak. And I thought, oh, no, I'm not having a good experience. This isn't good enough, you know? There are a lot, we feel we don't deserve the really good feeling, the joy. Or we think it's too self-centered. There's so much suffering in the world. We shouldn't allow ourselves to enjoy this. But really, how do we replenish? You know, if you feel more and more bereft and broken and overcome and exhausted, there's not a lot of energy inside to try to help someone else or even pay attention to someone else. So there's this whole notion about savoring, you know, learning to appreciate. Take it in. Take a moment and say, wow. Look at that. That feels good. Look at those blossoms. Forget what she said, you know? And that actually gives us the kind of inner resource. It's not selfish in the end. It shows loving kindness for ourselves in the same light is not selfish, because it helps build that reservoir out of which we can authentically give to someone else. Not because we feel obliged or we can't stand it, really. So Barbara's theory about positive emotion, which has gotten a lot of credence since this was in her earlier book, Positivity, is called Broaden and Build. We don't cultivate these positive states just for like a good feeling, and it's not something superficial and kind of endlessly seeking pleasure the way we do anyway, but it has the experience inhabiting or embodying these positive states like loving kindness, compassion, generosity, gratitude will broaden our perspective, first of all. And that's really interesting, right? Because we know the opposite when, and mindfulness really reveals the opposite, when we are locked into anger, we're locked into fear, we're locked into greed, not just the passing experience of those states, but when we're really in there, one of the main effects is tunnel vision, right? When you're, think about the last time you were really afraid. It's not likely to have been a time when you thought, you know what? If it doesn't work out this way, maybe it'll work out that way. It's like options are gone. They're off the table, right? Our world becomes really small and compressed. Or think about the last time you were angry at yourself. That's not likely also a time when you think, you know what? I did those 5 great things same morning that I did that really stupid thing. Those 5 great things, they're gone. Or we're full of desire, not kind of longing in the ordinary sense, but we're locked in, right? We need that object. We need that thing. We need that experience. It's the only thing that will ever make us happy. And were we to get it, it will make us happy forever. So we're leaving a lot out in that way of being. The truth of change, other possibilities, feeling sufficient without that thing, right? So the nature of being lost in those opposite states is tunnel vision. So it makes tremendous sense that as we cultivate these more positive states, it broadens our perspective. It opens our world. So I like that association with creativity. You know, it gives us more options. So it's not that you become this sort of stultified, self-righteous, you know, narrowly focused sort of person. Your world really opens up through the cultivation of these states. And I always find this so spooky. And I checked with her last time I saw her, just to confirm it. They did some studies that showed that the cultivation of these positive states will actually help your peripheral vision. And I thought, isn't that spooky? I couldn't believe it. I read that. Really? And then I asked her, she said, yeah. Think of that. Our world really broadens. And then the second part of that is build, which means, build inner resource. Because in truth, it gets harder and harder to meet adversity or challenge when we feel we have nothing happening within, right? We feel so kind of empty in that negative sense, so tired. We don't feel like we have resource or something happening that is actually going to be the wellspring out of which we can care about somebody else. So in Buddhist teaching, when they talk about generosity, material generosity, and remember those practices of loving kindness and things like that are like generosity of the spirit. So we often look to material generosity just for greater understanding because it's so concrete. So we look at material generosity, and we understand that, first of all, there are a lot of reasons, a lot of different motivations for an act of giving. We could give somebody something because we like them, because we want something in exchange, because the TV cameras are going, because we don't like them. We think it'll irritate them tremendously to own it. You know, like, there's so many options, and we might give because we feel obliged to. It's, you know, National Giving Day, or, you know, it's a religious stricture, or everyone in our family is giving and then all eyes turn to us, or, you know, whatever it is. The best kind of giving, they say, comes from a sense of inner abundance. Because it's not obligatory, it's not forced, it's not coerced. And we see that. I think that's why, you know, studies show that people who might have very little, relatively speaking, externally, materially, are often the most generous. And I've seen it certainly, I think, most notably probably practicing in Burma, for example, where I was in Burma mostly in the 80s. And you don't pay room and board even in the monasteries like the kind I went to practice, because everything you need is offered to you, everything, every morsel of food. The culture was sort of built around an appreciation of generosity. So you were honored as a Burmese person to have the chance to go to the monastery and offer food for as many people as you could afford to. You didn't offer the food, you gave the money and they cooked the food at the monastery. So as many people as you could afford to feed. And, you know, like on your birthday, for example, in Burma, you don't expect to celebrate by getting gifts, you expect to celebrate by giving gifts. That's how you honor it. So it's your birthday, you go off to the monastery and you offer as much money as you can to feed as many people as you can, or your daughter's graduating from high school, or somebody in your family dies and you want to honor their memory. So it's like every occasion you sort of go off to the monastery and you offer food. And those people in that time, maybe still, but certainly then, it was one of the poorest countries in the world, and every single morsel of food we got was offered. And people would often come, and they were so poor, and watch you eat. You know, like sometimes it was a family, sometimes it was a whole village would come together. And some of those places have a waiting list of like a year for people eager to give, right? And so I'd be there and just experience that day after day. And then I'd come back, you know? And I felt like I knew some number of people who, even though they had so much more materially or externally compared to the Burmese people, did not at all have the internal feeling that they had enough. And actually, it was much more difficult for them to give. So what about when we don't feel we have anything going inside? We don't have enough. Or using the idea of generosity of the spirit, what we can do could never be enough. Our contribution could never mean anything. It's so small, it's so meager, it's so measly. It's all the same mind state, right? And so the efforts we make toward the cultivation of positive emotion, which will build that sense of resource, will also very strongly have the effect of allowing us to keep giving, caring, not necessarily materially, but in terms of caring about others. It's got to come from somewhere. And that's why everything we do in the nature of like gratitude practice or loving kindness for ourselves especially is not considered at all selfish. You know, the very common example these days, of course, that people use is if you're on an airplane and they're doing the safety announcements and the flight attendant says, if the cabin pressure changes and the oxygen masks come down, put your own on first before you try to help anybody else. So I was talking to a writer friend of mine and I said, I don't think I can bear to use that example. I mean, it's a great example. It's the perfect example. But because it's so perfect, like every colleague I have has used it. I don't know if you used it in your book or not. Every colleague I have pretty much who's written a book has used it in their book. And I thought, I just can't bear it. At this point, it's like a cliche. And the person I was talking to, this friend, she said, oh, that's funny. I was just on an airplane the other day and they made that announcement and the woman sitting in the seat next to me said, I could never do that. I could never put my own oxygen mask on first. And I said, oh, maybe I can use it. You know, it's still like provocative and challenging and interesting. But think about that. I could never do that. It's too selfish to put my own oxygen mask on first. So that's the conditioning most of us have, which brings me to the question of daily practice, which I'm a giant advocate of. I'd said earlier somewhere that I'm the kind of person that's Very much helped by structure, which is true. So for me to have a commitment to sit every day is actually a lot easier than a commitment, say, to sit three times a week. Because if it's three times a week, you know, it'll be Monday, and I'll think, Monday's not a good day. Let me wait till Wednesday. I'll start on Wednesday. Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, great schedule. Then Wednesday comes around, I'll think, maybe I'll just sit three times over the weekend, right? Whereas if it's every day, it's every day. And it's like, there it is, right? Done or undone. So knowing that about myself, I offer that as a possibility. I don't think it's the end of the world if you don't sit every day, really. But you might find that's the easiest way possible to get a practice going. And it's almost like for once in our lives, we can try the easiest way rather than the hardest way. So, and not everybody feels you need to have that dedicated period of formal practice. Certainly we can practice mindfulness, whatever we're doing. We can remember loving kindness, walking down the streets of New York or sitting in somebody's waiting room. That's all true. But I think seeing my own experience and the experience of so many, the easiest way possible to try to bring more mindfulness and loving kindness into our day is to have that dedicated period. It doesn't have to be that long. I just, you know, speaking of neuroscientists, I just saw Richie Davidson in Milwaukee, where I was teaching for the first time, and he came up or down, I forget, from Madison. I don't know which direction this. And somebody asked, it was like a dinner party, and somebody asked some question like that, and I said something, and he said to me, you know, you only have to do 9 minutes a day. And I said, I don't know if it's that healthy to go for the bare minimum, you know. But science, at any rate, is showing us it's not 18 hours a day you've got to do, you know, in order to get these kind of effects. It's actually what people tell me, because I'm so identified with loving kindness practice in the eyes of the world. You know, somebody, not Richie, but another scientist said to me, you know, studies have shown that 9 minutes of mindfulness and only 7 minutes of loving kindness will really change your brain. I said, thank you. But isn't that remarkable? No one is saying 6 hours a day, 10 hours a day. If you can do 6 hours a day, I think that's a great experiment for a different kind of life. If you can only do 10 minutes, do the 10 minutes. And it counts. It's not nothing. If you can only do 3 minutes, do the 3 minutes so that you have that everydayness thing, that rhythm more established. Because if you're interested in bringing these qualities into your ordinary day, when you're at work or you're, you know, commuting or whatever it might be, I really believe the best way is to establish a dedicated practice. Because the difficulty with bringing something like mindfulness into an ordinary day is not doing it. It's not that complicated. It's remembering, right? So there are all these, you know, pretty well-known things, you know, which we've kind of mentioned, like Thich Nhat Hanh's don't pick up the phone on the first ring, let it ring three times and breathe. Well, that's a nice idea, but how are you going to remember when it's like high-pressure environment and, you know, lots of impatience in the room and the phone rings? You remember so much more easily if you sat that morning, really. So let's say 10 minutes a day, 10 to 20, every day, and for a limited period of time, as we've also talked about. Like, what's realistic for you? Not a lifetime commitment, say a month. Then at the end of the month, you should assess and evaluate, is this worth continuing? But as I said earlier, the place to look is not in your formal 10 minutes or whatever. It's in your life. You know, is it making a difference in how I relate to myself, to others, to strangers, all of that? And you will find, at least even in the beginning, I think you'll find glimmers. And if you continue on, you'll find more and more. Isn't that amazing? I'm like a different person. And I don't even know when it happened, right? So I am like a huge fan of daily practice. It doesn't have to be sitting. It could be walking. But it's not a time where you sit down thinking, I'll also figure out my vacation plan, right? Or my strategic plan for work. That may come up, but it's not our goal when we sit down. Our goal is just the cultivation of qualities like attention, awareness, loving kindness, compassion, and so on. And because most people do have more than one practice, and if you might have a practice like asana as well, which I can let Stephen speak to, but or maybe you already have, I don't know. But in terms of just the meditation, people divide it up in all kinds of different ways. Depending on how long you're sitting, you might start with some loving kindness or end with some loving kindness, have the body of your practice period be mindfulness. If you sit more than once, you might divide them up that way. You may be particularly intrigued by one practice and you just devote yourself to that for however long you want. As I said earlier, when I went to Burma in 1985 and I practiced for 3 months of loving kindness, that was the beginning of a 4-year period where my only practice was loving kindness. That's what I did every day, whether I was on retreat or I was just at home. And then that switched. And these days, when I sit every day and I do, it's almost all a kind of awareness practice. And then I do loving kindness walking down the streets of New York, if we ever run into each other, on airplanes, subways, things like that. Many people ask, when should I practice? Or, I mean, there's some people, it's intriguing, they're actually, some teachers actually are trying to tie the science of habit formation into the regularity of one's practice. So that's like an experiment. But that's things like have a visual cue. Like if you sit on a backjack or a zafu or something, have it out, right? Because you can only walk by that thing so many times without actually sitting down. I should say the irony of it is that even though no one is saying we have to do this 6 hours a day, it is genuinely tough to find 10 minutes, which I find extraordinary, right? It's actually very hard to have a daily practice and put it into practice, not just think about it. And yet that's the thing that is actually going to make for the changes. So unlike, I think, some people in the yogic tradition, you know, when people say, should I sit in the morning? Should I sit a certain time of day? Should I sit in the evening? Usually we say, you should sit whenever you're actually going to sit. And for some people, like for me, that's the morning. It's like I get up and I try to just do it. That's the best thing for me. Other people tell me they practice in the parking lot at work. You know, they drive in early and they sit and then they go to work. Or maybe it's the evening, which will help you sleep in a different way. It's very personal. People say, should I sit alone or should I sit with others? And that was some of the questions, actually, that you wrote out had to do with that. It depends. Not everyone has the luxury of a group. Some people do, which is fabulous, even intermittently to have the chance to sit with others. But clearly, you know, many people were on our own, and it's up to us to get up in the morning and or whatever. So you have to see what's available to you. Groups can be tremendously supportive, even for learning or study or a discussion, something like that. and practicing together if that happens. That's why those of you who were there last night when Lily was talking about the challenge we did in February, we seem to do in February on my website. It's a very strong community that develops because you know, oh, it's February. There's a lot of people doing this and people are blogging about their experience. And you say, oh, look at that, everyone's sleepy today or whatever, you know, and you just feel such a sense of community. And there's lots of stuff like that which can really be supportive. I, as you know, many of you know, have my own support group that we formed, just a small group of us formed for this friend of ours who said, if he wakes up in the morning and he turns right, he's at his desk and his computer. And if he turns left, he's at his sitting cushion. So we formed this group. There are only five of us all together, including this friend. And the idea is that when you've practiced, you send an email to the other four. And the subject line is always turned left. And if you want, you add something like, turned left, snowing at Kripalu, was mine yesterday. And it's incredibly supportive. It's happened for years now. And because it's people, community, I think it inevitably brings up everything that comes up in our minds in relationship to ourselves and to one another. But that's fine, because we can also laugh at ourselves a little bit. So, for example, because I've had a daily practice for so long, for months and months and months, I was the first one to write, always. And then I got really paranoid. I thought, oh, they think I'm showing off. You know, they think I'm just like a goody-goody. And I would wait like 7 hours. Then I'd write, oh, turned left. You know, but if we have a basic good humor about our own minds, it's incredibly supportive. So I teach one intensive 7-day retreat each year at the Insight Meditation Society of Loving Kindness to the tremendous gratitude of everybody. I moved it from February to May and just last year for the first time. And last year, after hearing me talk about this, I later ran into somebody and she said, oh, I formed a gratitude buddy system with someone at that retreat. We didn't know each other before the retreat, but we just decided each night we were going to contact each other and say what we had to be grateful for from the day and that it was really useful. So people form their own kind of support systems as well. You can go on retreat if you can, if your life circumstance allows that. Because as you see, you know, it's a tremendous sort of immersion. And then I'll just say one more thing and I'll ask you to talk about continuing a yoga practice. Speaking of the immersion, just as for those of you who are here for the first time, and even if you've been here before, to some degree, in the beginning it's kind of culture shock. Leaving for everybody is really sort of culture shock. Because even though we're not silent necessarily here, and we might be spending money and shopping and doing all those things, there's a tremendous amount of quieting that we've all done without realizing it, and kind of slowing down and sensitivity and so on. And the world is moving at a different pace. So at first, for almost everybody leaving, it's a little bit like, whoa. But you'll be fine, really. like culture shock, it's just a little bit of an adjustment. And remember to breathe. And if you have a few minutes, go off on your own. And those of you going to an airport will especially experience like, whoa, people are really fast and weird here. So the other part of the story that I told yesterday about dropping the jar when I was first doing loving kindness practice, and the month we opened up the center in Barrie, and I got to do it for a week before something happened to a friend of ours in Boston. So several of us had to suddenly leave the retreat, and I dropped the jar. And my first thought was, you are really a klutz, but I love you. So that story I tell all the time, because I think it's so indicative of the way the practice works in ways we don't even see it working at the time. The other part of the story is that we got into a car, a few of us, and went to Boston, and we stopped for lunch on the way. We had lunch. At the end of lunch, Jack Kornfield looked up and he said, "Does anybody have any money?" And it was like, oh, right. That's what they like out here. Money. You don't just get your tray, you know, and then, like, decide, do you want a bowl on a plate? Or, you know, like, money. So it's a little bit like that, often in leaving. And but you really will be okay, let me assure you. And loving kindness always helps as you're moving through that airport or you're sitting in the diner or wherever you choose to eat, things like that. So what about continuing a practice?
So I was just thinking about your describing the fact that we slow down, especially when there's silence and yoga and meditation. And I've done many, many retreats with Sharon at the Insight Meditation Society, and people get so slowed down. The center is not unlike Kripalu. It's in a big old building it's Pleasant Street, right? Yeah. It's on Pleasant Street, which is so perfect. But at the end of a retreat, from all the cars empty out from IMS on Pleasant Street, and everybody's driving about 10 miles an hour down the street. And especially after the 3-month retreat, you're like going like really slowed really down. But there is a benefit. There's something called the post-meditation experience, where there's a moment, because you're so attuned and sensitized, when you see your reality at work or at home with fresh eyes, just for a moment. You know what I'm talking about, Sharon? I remember once when I was a kid, we went to live in Europe for a year and we left our home. And when we came back, it was fresh eyes just for a couple of days. It was like, wow, this is a magic house I never realized. And then it goes away. So take advantage of the post-meditation experience to see a little bit with fresh eyes. We're having that right now. We have a new CEO, and she's only been here a few weeks. And I'm saying to her, Barbara, take advantage of this. You're going to see stuff now that you will never see again in your next 10 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So as far as maintaining a practice, Sharon, I'm very like you are in the sense that structure really is essential for me. Uh-huh. So here's my practice. Twice a week, I sit, and I live in Albany now, and I looked really hard for the practice center, the group that I wanted to sit with, and there's a Shambhala center in Albany. So twice a week I sit there, and I sit for an hour and a half, which I really like. I do mm-hmm. both shamatha and vipassana. And there is a certain, I don't know if this is cheating, but there's a certain kind of drafting that you get from the group. Mm-hmm. We sit and we walk and we sit and we walk. And there's also this mechanism called cueing, psychological cueing, which is if you do your practice at the same time and place every day on a regular basis, you get cued into that same state. The environment and the physical environment cues you back into the state. So it's a little bit of a support. So twice a week I do an hour and a half of meditation. Twice a week I do a yoga class, a hot yoga class. I'm really into hot yoga uh-huh. right now. And uh-huh. for years we had Bikram yoga here. Bikram actually is a good friend of ours. He came and built us a studio on his specifications. And so hot yoga for Bikram is 110 degrees. But my hot yoga is 90 degrees, which is just about right. And I got a beautiful teacher. I love that. So twice a week I do that. Twice a week I meditate. Once a week I have a chanting group. So just recently, chanting is probably the oldest practice in the yoga lexicon. It's certainly the origin of meditation because these monks discovered 2,000 years ago that by concentrating the mind on a sacred syllable like Om over and over again, the mind becomes very absorbed. It's everything we talked about on opening night around absorption and concentration. So I have a group that meets in my office once a week, and we chant for an hour. And that's like an hour of guaranteed bliss. And then once a month, I have a Dharma group. My Dharma group meets at my house tonight. Oh. Yeah, we talk about Dharma. And then on the weekends, I wing it. Like, what do I really feel like doing today? Do I want to do yoga or meditation or chant? Sometimes I chant. I live 50 minutes away. Sometimes I chant all the way from my house in Albany to Kripalu, which I'm not necessarily recommending because you can get very expansive, and I'm not saying it's the safest thing in the world. I do it, and it's lovely. There's only one stoplight between me and Albany. So yeah, structure, regularity. It's in my schedule, and everybody knows it. Where's Steve? Oh, it's Tuesday between 5:30 and 7. He's at Shambhala. Everybody knows it. I know it. It's booked in. That's the only way I can do it, Sharon. And you'll notice that combination of yoga and hatha yoga and meditation. I put up here the eight limbs of yoga, and any of you who are yogis know that the practice of hatha yoga, or what we call asana, which actually literally means seat, pranayama, breathing, and pratyahara, absorption.
Oh, okay. It still says it's on.
It sounds like it's on. It came back on. Yeah, it came back on. Asana, pranayama, these two are yama and niyama, which are basically ethical practice. It's off. Ethical practice, and then asana, pranayama, and pratyahara, the next three in the eight limbs, are specifically to cultivate the qualities, the physical qualities, the physiological qualities that lend themselves to meditation. So you'll notice very often when I worked with you over the weekend, we started with some kind of movement. We did a little stretching on our feet, or we did chair yoga. That's because those practices are intentionally created to promote the right physiology in the body. We're back on. To promote the practice of deep meditation. What do? They attenuate states of hyperarousal, which many of us live in. I don't know about you, but I'm a very busy guy. I find when I sit down that there's a certain amount of hyperarousal. The kind of the mainline approach to dealing with hyperarousal is directly through the body. So when we work with, so the most intense form of hyperarousal, for example, is PTSD. That's a refractory state that never ends. So we found with our PTSD patients, vigorous yoga poses and pranayama more than anything else goes right in. It's an intervention into the physiology, calms them down. Then they can meditate, maybe for a brief period. But we all live on some spectrum of hyperarousal. And so these are very, very effective. The final three, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, are actually different levels of concentration and mindfulness. So there's a hierarchy here which is very effective, and I pretty much follow it in my own practice. And we do here at Kripalu too. Did you notice the new rug in the lobby?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a new rug that has the eight limbs all around the, like a big wheel. And of course, Buddhism has an eightfold path. Do you want to say what that is?
I can't remember. But it's funny because Lily said, I never noticed this rug before, thinking she just hadn't been mindful. And I said, oh, maybe it's new, which is true. Yeah, I mean, there is an Eightfold Path in Buddhist teaching as well. And we'll just, I'll say that and we'll we'll sit together and close because you have to fill out evaluations. And it's basically three chunks of activity which make up a life. You know, even though it's not classically where it starts, there's a whole chunk that has to do with how we live. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Isn't that interesting? Livelihood has its own limb. Because after all, if we spend an awful lot of our day in a certain way, it has an effect. One of the things about a teaching like the Eightfold Path is that inner work and outer work are very connected, right? So if you practice generosity externally, as an example, it's part of right action, then internally, the ability to let go gently, relinquish what we don't really need, strengthens. And as we practice that, the ability to be generous externally strengthens. So these teachings are very profound for that reason, that nothing we do is wasted, you know? It's all part of, like, the unified field of our lives, which are seamless. So there's that whole realm, right speech, right action, right livelihood. There's the realm of meditation, right effort, right concentration, right mindfulness. And then the two, which actually classically begin the Eightfold Path, because it's not a path in a linear sense, it's a cycle, are right view, it's like worldview about life, and right intention, you know, having intentions of generosity and loving kindness and so on, rather than greed, hatred, and delusion. So they say we start with that because we need enough right view to think this path may be worth pursuing. I don't know that it really is, but we need enough so that we have a sense of this isn't just an academic exercise. This isn't just a book for my cousin, right? This is something to breathe life into, to experiment with, so I can see for myself if it's worth doing. So that's the idea of right view and right intention coming at the beginning, and then we make the experiment through how we live, how we speak to one another, how we practice meditation, and all of that leads to a more refined right view and right intention. So our friend Sylvia calls it the Eightfold Dot. It's just kind of going round and round and round and round, which is really true. So in terms of loving kindness practice, if you are exploring it at a more reasonable pace, there are kind of classical categories. And again, it's not like every session, but over a longer period of time, we explore the offering of loving kindness to each of these categories, or something like them, because it's just emblematic of an unfolding of a life. You know, we have those we feel very close to, those we don't know that well, and so on. So classically, we begin with ourselves. We offer loving kindness to a benefactor, someone who's helped us or inspired us, even if we've never met them. We offer loving kindness to a friend. And if you want to get very much more refined in your practice, you might offer loving kindness to a friend who's doing well right now, or a friend who's not doing so well right now. So it has a flavor of sympathetic joy or compassion. We offer loving kindness to a neutral person, which is my kind of secret favorite. You know, that is the person you see periodically. That's like that woman in the grocery store. You see periodically, you don't have a real relationship with, you don't have a strong feeling about. Because over time, what you discover is that the offering of loving kindness in your meditation means you're paying attention to that person, even not knowing their story. So that over time, you see that you see them and you see them, and it's not like seeing a stranger anymore. there's something much more profound that happens. So that's fun. You know, that woman in the animation became my neutral person. And then I had to move. I lost my sublet, so I had to move like 8 blocks away, which in New York City, as many of you know, is like a world away, like different grocery store and different everything. But every once in a while, I'd be back in that old neighborhood and I'll walk by and I'll go, ooh, I wonder if she's in there, you know? We offer loving kindness to a difficult person. The suggestion is not right away the person who has hurt us the most hideously in this life or has behaved so horribly on the world stage. Not that we never go there, and not that it's wrong if you decide to go there, but it's hard, right? There are a lot of very real questions that it's not exactly that we figure them out along the way, but we have different experiences along the way. Like if you start with a person who annoys you slightly and slowly make your way to a more and more difficult person, there's time for those experiences to cook. So that even if you don't have the words to express it, you've gone through something so that you're better able to understand what it does mean to have compassion for yourself as well as for someone else. Or compassion for someone and knowing at the same time it's wrong to give in to them, that you're not going to do that. Or compassion for somebody and realizing, I can't fix it. I can't make it all better. So again, you may not have the words and we're not analyzing that along the way, but you're going through different stuff. So that's the idea of, you know, not starting right away with just the most unthinkably hard person. But I find most people want to. So I'm just saying that. If it's too hard, it's always correct to go back to offering loving kindness to yourself. And then finally, loving kindness for all beings everywhere. So as I said, we, in any one sitting, we usually just have the bookends. We start with ourselves. We end with all beings. And depending on how much time you have or what's happening in your life, maybe there's one being in between, you know, or two. It depends. And it's really up to you. So thank you so much. It's been a tremendous delight to be with you all. We actually, you know, we have dates for next year already for those people who like to live in the future. And I hope to see you again somewhere.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Sharon's many offerings and her ongoing teaching schedule, please visit her website at SharonSalzberg.com.